Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Immigration and asylum, border security, the abolish ICE movement, and of course the building of a southern border wall, long promised by President Trump, all issues regularly visited in our news that impact our countries and our state's Latino communities. This hour, we want to better understand the context of these Latino-related news stories and better understand, in doing that, the history and the culture of our Latino communities here in Iowa in the Midwest. Joining us to do that the entire hour, Rene Rocha. You've heard him often on our Politics Wednesday today, but he's with us today for this special theme. He's a professor of political science and Latino studies at the University of Iowa. Rene, welcome back to our studio.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Also joining us this half hour, Joe Enrique Henry, advisor to the national president for the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC. Joe Henry, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, before we get too far into this, I want to clear up one bit of terminology that is new to me and is going to be something new to, I imagine, quite a number of our listeners that we'll be using throughout the hour. Latinx, a term that is an inclusive term, meaning a person of Latin American origin or descent. And before we get further in this, Rene, Latinx will be used interchangeably, more or less, with Latino in this conversation. Why has Latinx entered the vocabulary?
Yeah, well, like in a lot of different ways, people have tried to get a little bit more aware, conscious, and sensitive of sort of different gender identities. And this poses a really particular problem when you're looking at words which are sort of rooted in sort of more Romance languages and which have sort of nouns that have masculine or feminine identifications. And so, you know, there are some ways of identifying the Latino or Latinx community. A word like Hispanic doesn't necessarily have that, but the word Latino obviously does. And there's been a lot of movement over the course of years to sort of expand that from Latino to Latin. If you look at a lot of writing, sometimes you get sort of like Latino/A kind of going on, right?
Makes conversation more awkward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, even that sort of sticks with a very traditional gender binary. And as you think about individuals who may identify outside of that binary, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated. And so Latinx is a way of sort of like taking us out of that strict binary has been a movement that a lot of people have pushed for to create sort of more inclusive language.
Mm-hmm. Did I mispronounce that? Is it Latinx or Latinx?
There's no settled. That's a big controversy.
That's a debate.
there is no settled answer to that question. You'll find everyone has their own sort of
Joe Henry, what's your opinion on that before we move on?
Stating it anyway is just fine. And you know, it's, you know, depending on the group that you're talking with, especially if you're speaking with a younger group, they do prefer Latinx or Latinx. So that's good. You know, other folks in different communities look to us as the Latino community, and sometimes they refer to us as the Hispanic community.
Okay, so there was a third pronunciation, Latinx.
Yes.
Did you say Latinx?
I did say Latinx.
Okay.
I have heard
that.
Got
another one to deal with.
I have heard that one. So it's good. We're being acknowledged in many different ways.
Okay, yes. Very good. Oh, we want to reach out to our listeners to acknowledge those listening and hopefully taking part in this conversation this hour. Are you part of Iowa's Latinx, Latino or Latina community? Why don't you share something about yourself if you are, your community, your experience that helps us better understand what it means to be Latinx in Iowa, in the Midwest at this time, in this day and age. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Later in the hour, we want to talk about an event which Rene is co-directing. Very interesting. Also, maybe hard to pronounce, Imagining Latinadas. Latinadas?
Latinadas.
Latinadas.
Yes, also hard to pronounce. We're going to challenge you here, Ben.
Okay. There's a symposium coming up on October 25th, which is open to the public, about migration. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah,
but
sounds good.
Just a heads up on that. Joe, let me turn to you first of all,
sure.
Because if there's one theme in this hour is we want to, of course, get to some of the intersections of Latinx, the population community, with the news that I mentioned at the outset here. But before we do that, I wonder if you can give us a quick history of Latinx in Iowa, our communities, Latino communities in Iowa and the Midwest. And I'm guessing in the telling, very quick nutshell telling of this, we're going to dispel some myths. For instance, Latinos are new to this part of the country, right?
We have always been part of this country. We have always been part of the United States. We have a saying within our community is that we did not cross the border crossed us. Latinos, especially when you look at when somebody does their DNA, Latinos show up as Native Americans. So our history goes back thousands of years. Now, for Iowa, if we just kind of track things as far as census data goes, our community has been here since the 1880s, possibly even earlier than that. We're about 200,000 folks in our community here in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So we're 6% of the population, but we're about 20% of the K-12 kids here in Iowa. So when you look at the 500,000 kids in K-12 schools across the state of Iowa, we're about 100,000. So we are growing exponentially. And we have been doing that since the early twos. In the 1980s, our population was about 60,000. So here we are now at nearly 200,000 in Des Moines, Iowa, where we have the largest school district. Of the 33,000 kids, we're about 27% of the population of those kids. Mm. So quite a growing community we are.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, too, your thoughts about, because when you have that large of a youth population, which is Latino, that is a huge shaping factor in Iowa's future. But before we get there, talk a little bit, let me turn to you, Renee, about sort of when we think about more recent immigrants, Latino immigrants to our state. Why have Latinos come here? What kind of jobs? Give us a profile.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Joe's referencing that you have an established community, but you have a community that's really growing. And so there are really two sources of that growth. And one of the things that Joe's pointing to is basically as people come and they live in Iowa and they develop families and they have children and people grow. And that's a source of population growth, is this sort of like just, you know, having people born and raised in the state. But then you also have people who are coming to the state for the first time. And, you know, what's happening in Iowa is not a lot of different than what was happening in states like Texas or California or other sort of agricultural producing states decades ago, which is that there are labor needs. And when you sort of run out of a domestic supply for labor to meet those needs, then it's, you know, common for people for those needs to be met by immigrant labor. Mm-hmm. And so you have a variety of sectors of the sort of Iowan economy where you have immigrants sort of clustering, you know, meatpacking, other types of agricultural production. And that creates not just a sort of growing Latino population, but one of the things it does is it really sort of sometimes concentrates that population in particular communities. So, you know, we're talking here in Iowa City. We're just 20 miles away from West Liberty, Iowa, which is actually a town that has a majority Latino population. I mean, when I first moved to this state back about 13 or 14 years ago, I was shocked that I found myself in a town that was just like a short drive away from a majority Latino town. Right. But that's Iowa today.
We have other towns. Joe Henry, we have Marshalltown, right?
We do. 50%. Go ahead.
No, yes. Mount Pleasant. I was just going to help me try to locate the Latino communities and just highlight them.
Well, the thing is, we are all over the place. We have 957 communities here in Iowa. So when you look at some of these smaller communities, especially like Storm Lake, and again, you said Marshalltown, West Liberty, Muscatine in Davenport is always a growing Latino community there. But here in Polk County, we are the largest population here. Sioux City is another good example. The second largest population for our community is in the Sioux City area. And then over again by Scott County, over Davenport. So we are filling in those areas of employment that is necessary for Iowa to continue to grow. And as was stated, when we look at the service sector, agriculture, construction, those are some key areas that our community fills. And when we look at the Latino community, we also look at the immigrant community. So there is an overlap there, and our community plays a part in all those sectors.
Right. And Joe, Renee mentioned, the latest immigrants coming to fill a need for workers that Iowa didn't otherwise have. Now, in your opinion, Joe, is this at all controversial? Because we hear, and perhaps we're getting into something, address this claim that is made, coming here to take our jobs. What about that claim?
Well, definitely not taking other people's jobs. What we see here in Iowa is the ongoing movement of folks from families, specifically white families, who have done well here in Iowa through their employment, through different industries. And what they've done is, they've encouraged their kids to do higher level types of occupations. So we see a lot of what we call white flight out of many small communities to the urban sectors. So what has happened in those cases, that has left those areas, especially in agriculture, open to the need for employment, employing people from other areas of the country. So Latinos, immigrants have been there to take on that work in the agricultural sector, have taken on that work in meatpacking, mm-hmm. in the service sector. 50% plus of the agricultural workers are come from the immigrant community. That is a very important.
Yeah, 50%.
Very, very important. And that is mm-hmm. something for those farmers who do soybean, who do corn, dairy, this should be an important thing to them about taking on the issue of how do we resolve some of the issues on a political front that have been discussed in the state legislature and, of course, on the national front is the importance of providing legal status to new Iowans, to immigrants. That is a discussion that has not happened as much. It needs to happen more so.
Right. Yeah. And the big debate, comprehensive immigration reform in
Correct.
This country, something that both parties wish would happen, that both parties cannot, seem to agree on.
Yeah.
did I put that correctly, you think,
yeah.
Renee?
Well, I think there's an important point here in what Joe was just talking about, mm-hmm. which is that when we talk about these things, we sometimes want to talk about them in a zero-sum way. All right, if an immigrant comes and takes a job, then there's a native-born worker who won't be able to take the job. But that's not the way that economies work. And so what happens is that immigration can help increase overall productivity, and therefore you have a situation in which sort of everybody's better off, right? The economy is just producing more, and therefore wages are higher for everybody. Employment mm-hmm. opportunities are better for everybody. It's not the case that you just have one job and somebody else takes that job and somebody else doesn't take that job. And so, in a state like Iowa, which has a declining population, the idea of keeping our economic productivity in the state high requires sort of new people to come in, requires economic growth to come from finding new sources of labor. The other thing here is that, it's just like a matter of social science. I'm a social scientist by training. So a lot of people have studied this and a lot of people have failed to produce any really convincing evidence that immigration or living in places with lots of immigrants sort of declines wages for native-born workers. Right, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it increases wages for some people, maybe doesn't have an effect for others. So, mm-hmm. that concern is just a little bit, sort of not borne out by the social science.
Renee Rocha is with us, as well as Joe Enrique Henry of LULAC. We're talking about Latinx communities here in Iowa, how they were founded, but also some of the ways they're intersecting with our news and have for several years in terms of the immigration debate, border security, ICE we want to talk about, too, before we say goodbye to Joe Henry. But join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And let me jump right into some of these news items concerning what we've been hearing. Headline, Joe, let me throw this to you in the news. What presents the biggest challenges for the Latino community or perhaps divides the Latino community here in Iowa when it comes to controversy?
Our biggest concern right now is the need for comprehensive immigration reform. not having that has been something that has been held against us for many decades now. We really do need to resolve that. That's something that Congress should have dealt with a while back. And, of course, here with the state legislature, there's things that could be done to provide legal status for undocumented immigrants. That is the thing that's the hot button item that continues to come up over and over again. So we need to get that resolved. Once we do get that resolved, then, of course, there's the other important issues as far as, you know, good paying jobs, health care, free education, those items. But again, comprehensive immigration reform is something that we really need to work on, get that resolved. And that also has to do with what's going on with ICE, not only in our state, but across the country, due to the present person in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's, before we delve further into ICE, let's talk with Isaac. Isaac is calling. I don't see on my screen exactly where. Isaac, where are you calling from, please? Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm currently calling from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Wow,
I'm in Iowa, outside the Iowa border. I'm a first-generation Iowan, born in the Quad Cities, and I'm a first-generation Mexican-American. I was born in the Quad Cities but raised up in Marshalltown, Iowa.
Excellent. Mm. And what was your observation or question for today?
Well, no, I'd just like to thank all of you, and you know, special thanks to Joe Henry and also Rene Rocha. You know, Rene, I'm an alumnus from the University of Iowa, and he was a professor of mine. I'm a proud member of LULAC, Council 308.
And, it's
very important to have these conversations, and I think, you know, the Latino Latinx community is not monolithic. And with that being said, there's a whole variety of terminology that people choose to identify themselves with. For example, you know, I respond to Latinx, Latino, Mexican-American, and I think there's such rich history within our community that really, you know, when folks want to know more about us, they could be like, hey, you know, ask us, how do you identify? And then,
right,
you know, we can, you know, then have that rich conversation with that individual. And, you know, my experience here in Iowa has taught me how to have a tough skin, but also deep down, you know, the relationships that I've built with Iowans throughout my 23 years, going on 24 years now in the state, has been wonderful. And it just shows that, you know, deep down, people have a good heart. And as neighbors, you know, we're all there for each other.
Isaac, thank you very much for your thoughts as a first-generation Iowan and first-generation Mexican-American, as you self-identified there. Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Hey, you too. Let's go quickly to Eric in Burlington. Eric, welcome to the program. We're coming up on a break. Eric, I'll ask you to be brief. We're sure glad to have you on the program. Welcome.
I'll be brief. These are human beings. They need to be treated with dignity and respect and not exploited. But the point I want to make is, if you bring people into this country, I want them to be able to be folks that, if they work hard and everything, they don't require that we support them with food stamps and, mm-hmm, and some of these other things, because if that's the case, then you're basically magnifying the social output that you have to put out just to gain cheaper labor.
Okay.
And, you know, ultimately, that's the only thing that worries me. Otherwise, these are human beings. They need to be treated with dignity and respect.
Eric, thank you so much. Bringing up an important point that has been on our news, has been raised by our president in terms of people accepted into this country, like whether they need social services
right? Yeah. Well, first I want to say hi to Isaac, who called earlier. We're very proud to count him as an alumni. But I think he actually illustrates another point here, which is that, you know, he's born and raised in Iowa. He's in Ohio right now. What he didn't mention, he's there going to law school.
Yeah.
Right. And he's so that next wave of Latinos in the country who are becoming lawyers and becoming professionals. Right. So it's not just the immigrants who are coming and working in agriculture production. Then this is what happens in that next generation. It's very important
to Eric's point, though.
To Eric's point. What I'll say is that, you know, actually, I mean, as a matter of federal law, states are allowed to decide if immigrants can access welfare benefits or they cannot. So it's not, so states actually have the authority to not allow immigrants to access welfare benefits.
That's already established.
And mm-hmm, of course, unauthorized immigrants can access any welfare benefits at all. If you're in the country without documentation, you can't go collect a TANF check. So that's really sort of a myth, that this idea that you would like have illegal immigrants collecting food stamps. That's just that's just not true.
I mean, yeah, and I think it's very important to really state here is not only do immigrants, especially undocumented, do not rely on these programs, cannot access them. When you look at the immigrant community here in Iowa, which is 5% of the population, that provides $3 billion in buying power per year. We need to look at the fact that immigrants are rebuilding this state, have rebuilt this state within the last 10 to 15 years. And that's something that does not that's not spoken about. So we need to look at that. A lot of research has been done on that. Iowa would be having negative population growth over the last 10 years had it not been for the movement of immigrants to here to Iowa to do the type of work that is needed here in Iowa.
Joe Henry, we're going to say goodbye to you in a couple minutes. Before we do, I want to get your thoughts, because this is something that will carry on into the second half hour, about the Abolish ICE movement. This is a movement that we've seen in our news since 2018. I think the president seeded this, and it's grown into quite a controversy. The Abolish ICE movement proposes the elimination of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat faded from our headlines. Other things having overtaken it. How much of a divide is there here, especially in the Latino community?
Well, for the most part, we in the Latino community really are opposed to ICE. We see this. This fear that happens due to ICE, especially in our mixed status families, where some of our family members may be undocumented, and having that fear that ICE will come to our doorsteps and then arrest somebody, detain somebody, is a very scary thing. We need to abolish this. This was something that was established after 2001, 9/11. It is unnecessary. We are now hearing the Democratic presidential candidates talk about the need to remove this. Julian Castro has a pretty good proposal on how to deal with undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. We need to look at that. There needs to be only civil penalties. This should not be a crime when somebody comes over here in this country. We have to realize it wasn't until 1929 that it was not a crime beforehand to come across into our country. And again, it's very important to note is that we have always been here. And one last thing I would like to say is if you're not already related to a Latino, you soon will be, because we are 60 million people strong within the United States, and we continue to grow and play our part in this infrastructure of our country.
Mm-hmm. I can give you 30 seconds more, but spin that out a little bit more about the future. Where will we be in terms of in Iowa? Iowa's, I think, still the fifth whitest state in the country. Rapidly increasing our diversity, largely thanks to the Latino population.
Correct. And within the next 20-some years, we're going to be about 15% of the population here across the state. And, of course, now we're 20% of the school-age kids, so that's 100,000 kids in schools. Our median age is 23, so we're a very young group. So things are changing, and things are looking better for our state due to our community and the immigrant community.
Joe Enrique Henry, thank you very much for joining us. Advisor to the National President for the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC. Thanks for coming to our studio, Joe.
Thank you, and thank you, Renee.
Thanks. Good talking to you, Joe.
When we come back, Rene Rocha will stay with us, and we'll have one of his colleagues join us to talk about an upcoming symposium that you can attend. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, exploring some Latino themes in our news. We have Rene Rocha with us, professor of political science and Latino studies at the University of Iowa. Also with us this half hour, a new guest, Daryl Wanser Serrano, director of the Latino Studies Program and associate professor of Latino and Latina Studies at Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
This half hour, we want to talk about that intersection between Latino community interests and our news, the abolish ICE movement. We want to continue talking about that. Also, the immigration debate, asylum. We haven't touched really on that. Border security and so forth. We want to invite our guests to join us, especially if you're part of Iowa or the Midwest's Latino or Latina community. Share something about yourself. Tell something about your community, about your experience to help us better understand what it means to be Latino in the Midwest, in Iowa. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River-to-river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming symposium. The two of you are co-directors, two of the three co-directors of this series of symposiums. Tell us about it, Daryl. What is this symposium based on?
Yeah, so the programming that we're doing over the course of the year is six different speaking events. We had our opening conference last month and our first kind of one-day symposium this month. And they're all kind of oriented around different ways of kind of approaching and understanding Latina, Latino, Latinx people locally, nationally, and globally. And so the one that's coming up is on the theme of migration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so dig down into migration. What aspects of migration are you focusing on?
Yeah, well, we kind of got a lot of different things going. So we have people who are coming in and they're talking about rhetoric, the way we talk about immigrants. That's obviously a really important thing in today's climate, right? And so you have when you talk about abolish ICE, like you were doing, you know, at the sort of midpoint there, there's abolish ICE is a really like substantive idea, you know, do you really want to sort of dismantle this organization? But it's also important to think about it in terms of its rhetoric, in terms of just the way you're talking about immigration. Are you talking about sort of this idea of approaching it from more understanding or humanitarian ways? Are you thinking about approaching it from a more punitive sort of enforcement-oriented type of vocabulary? So that's like one theme that's being explored. You also have people, we have an artist coming who's a former DACA, who's a DACA recipient. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to be, sort of like talking about the ways in which that's informed his artistic expression. So all kinds of different perspectives and voices we're going to bring.
And the DACA program is a program initiated by then President Obama to look after Latinos who were born in this country, perhaps to undocumented parents and so forth. But we're nevertheless, this is the only home they've ever had. And now they are still in a sort of a netherworld, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Until this gets settled, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the Supreme Court just agreed to take a case reviewing this. So we'll be looking forward to what happens with that over this session of the court.
Mm-hmm. What else in the symposium are you looking at, Renee?
So we have we have three speakers, so that's sort of hitting the two of them, and then we have sort of other people who are sort of thinking about it in a more global perspective, and sort of we're then going to bring everyone together, and we have this nice round table, and we get all these people who come from different places. You know, one's a sociologist, one studies rhetoric, one's an artist, and we have them talk to each other and we have them engage the audience. And that's a really important part of what we're doing here, is engaging the audience being the public, you know, the people in our community, people in Iowa City or in the state or nationally. Mm-hmm. You know, the events are held in Iowa City. This next one's at Merge. Some of our other events are at the Iowa City Public Library. So if you're in the area, you can come.
Merge is downtown Iowa City, but of course, is the library.
Mm-hmm. But it's also important that we're live streaming the events and they're being posted on our website. So, you know, if you're interested and you're just not in the Johnson County area.
Mention the website, please.
Yeah, yeah. So if you just go to a search engine, put in imaginingLatina.is. If you don't spell it correctly, that's okay. Just get close enough, you'll end up there. And then you can find links to follow us on social media, to do our live streaming. You can come and ask questions on social media as well. And then we can sort of bring them up in our events.
Mm-hmm. So Daryl, why are a series of symposia like this needed? Why do we need it? It tells me that there's some common myths that need to be dispelled, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why we decided to do this. I mean, I think that despite the fact, as we heard in the earlier in the hour, that Latinx folk have been in Iowa for so long, I think there's still a general, kind of broad lack of understanding, and so part of what we wanted to be able to do with this series of events is educate people on campus, locally in the community, and across the state, especially since Iowa is so important to the emerging national conversations leading into, you know, presidential season.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the Abolish ICE movement that proposes the elimination of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Now, the movement is opposed by people who assume that this is an encouragement of unlawful immigration and asylum seeking. What do you say to the people who really do have these concerns? I want to have secure borders, right? I want to have lawful asylum seekers. I want to have lawful immigration. Those are claims, ideas that we can't begrudge people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of ideas going on in what you just said. And, you know, it's important to remember that the asylum process isn't unlawful. You're allowed to come to the United States, present yourself at a port of entry, and seek asylum. Now, maybe we don't handle and process those asylum cases in a very efficient way. That's sort of a function of the way we've structured our immigration courts, right? But those individuals aren't doing anything necessarily unlawfully. Now, some people enter the country unlawfully, and you know, there's a criticism of, well, they should enter the right way. They should, you know, Joe Biden in one of the last presidential debates was, well, you know, I believe people should get in line. And I think an important thing that people don't understand is, like, what does that mean? What's that line? What's that line look like? How long is it?
We hear that tossed around a lot. Get in line like previous generations of immigrants have.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important to understand that that line has changed a lot across time. And nowadays, we're actually in a place where, say, if you're a low-skilled Mexican origin worker trying to enter the United States, you know, to come work in a meatpacking plant in West Liberty, Iowa, that line is decades long. So there, it basically, and if that line is decades long, then there is no line. There's no legal path. And so that's an important part for people to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Daryl, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think another part of this is it's important to historicize how we talk about immigration. Like, you know, as Renee mentioned, that line, the kind of like the concept of the line and how, you know, how people have access to it has changed a lot over the years, as has the way that we think about kind of the border and security. So, like, this obsession with security in the border is kind of, you know, relatively new.
Well, we can date it to 9/11.
Yeah.
With good reason, when we have the largest, terrorist attack on our soil committed, we're going to be hypervigilant, right? That's understandable.
Sure, except that we're hypervigilant about the southern border, right? And we kind of think about the southern border in terms of security and threat to security, but we don't usually think about the northern border in quite the same way. And what I'm getting at is there is a kind of racial component to this and to the way that that the immigration policy is crafted and kind of disproportionately applied to people coming from Mexico and throughout the Americas.
Without data to back up why we should be more concerned about the southern border.
Sure.
Despite the rhetoric of the president talking about rapists and other types of criminal elements coming
from
the southern border.
Yeah, to put some numbers on what Daryl's saying, you know, the unauthorized population in the United States is, roughly about half individuals of Latin American origin. Over 95% of the people we deport are of Latin American origin, right? And so, like, everyone we deport comes from Mexico or Central America or a handful of South American countries. And, you know, that's just not proportionate to what that population looks like in the United States. Why is that, right? And, I don't think why it is because of national security. That's not a population which has produced many national security threats in the United States.
Mm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Renee Rocha with us, Latino Studies at the University of Iowa, also professor of political science. Daryl Wanser Serrano, his colleague, director of Latino Studies program at the University of Iowa. Let's go back to our phones talk with, I think it's Belkis. Is it Belkis or Belkis calling from Iowa City? Forgive me if I got your name wrong.
That's fine. My name is Becky, and I wanted to mention three things. And one is, I think it's important for people to know that the term Latinx is a term that was created in the United States in the academia. in the United States, and a lot of people in Latin America don't necessarily either don't know the term or do not agree with the term. That has to be with the fact that it's an X in between two consonants, and that is not even possible to pronounce in the Romance language, particularly in Spanish. So that has to do more with that than what it actually represents. And some people would think or talk about how is that we didn't include a vowel in there, like an E or an I or just a neutral vowel. Mm-hmm. That was one point. And the other two points is that a lot of people relate Latinos to workers, in the labor workers. And I think the geographic has changed. And a lot of people have come from different countries and different education degrees. And the University of Iowa is actually a good example of that. If you go to the hospital, you're going to find a lot of medical doctors who are Latinos. I particularly have a PhD as well. So I think when we think about Latinos, we think about a particular part of the population, and I think that has changed, including here in Iowa. And the third point is that I am an immigrant, and I think ICE should be dismantled. So those were my three points.
Thank you very much. Response from perhaps you, Daryl, to that, and going back to this point of with the increasing Latino population here in the Midwest and Iowa, that the second generation, the succeeding generations, are filling workplace positions that weren't filled before by Latinos. Right? They're moving on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think an important part of that that'll keep that trend going is as the kind of like educational dynamics change. You know, it's really only in the last decade that places like the University of Iowa have been recruiting at increasing numbers Latinx students to get their degrees here. And I think that the now half of finally in the last couple of years, over half of the Latino students that the university has recruited are from Iowa, which is great because, you know, as you were talking about earlier in the hour, the Latino population in the state is pretty young, right? Yeah. And college age, you know, when we're talking about 18 to 24-year-olds, it's close to 9% of the state's population.
Right, and to get the last 2 weeks, I've been on vacation. A good part of that, spending it in California. Now, if you don't get out of Iowa much, you might not realize how diverse our country is in other parts. I mentioned Iowa is the fifth whitest state. Now, go to a place like California, and you will, in many settings, be as a white person in a minority. There will be a lot of Asians and a lot of Latinos there. So it all goes to say that, you know, that this may be part of our future.
Exactly.
This will be our future.
This will be a part of our future, right? And so, I mean, 27% of the students in Des Moines, I didn't know that when Joe said that earlier in the hour. I think that's pretty striking. And, you know, I think that when you're facing the situation, you got to think to yourself, is this a community that you want to continue to ostracize and marginalize? Or is this a community that you want to work with and integrate?
Right. Okay. But change of many different sorts is causes anxiety.
Absolutely.
So when the world that you grew up in doesn't look like the world of the present and in the future, it may cause anxiety. How do you quell those anxieties? How do you address those anxieties?
Well, you know, I think an important part of like the events that Daryl and I are putting on is part of this broader theme of engaging those communities. Because the worst thing you can do is have people who do not look like you around you, but have you not interact with them, right? Mm-hmm. That creates fear. That creates the sort of this unknown. But once you actually start working with individuals, meeting them, engaging them socially, engaging them intellectually, what you learn is that people are people, right? And a lot of your stereotypes and a lot of your fears and your anxieties get diminished once you actually develop those human connections. And so educating yourself by going out and going in different social spaces or just expanding your sort of educational experiences is a really important part of dealing with that anxiety.
Let's go back to our phones. Is it
Luis
in Des Moines with perhaps some kids in the background? We'll take those kids along with Luis. Hi, Luis, are you there?
Oh, hi. Sorry. I did not know I wasn't there. Thank you for having
no
me.
No problem whatsoever. We like to hear the younger generation there in Des Moines. What's on your mind?
Well, on my mind, I just wanted to thank you guys for having this conversation. It's very important to inform our communities, specifically, I like to encourage the listeners to engage more in conversations with your neighbors, with your friends, at church, because like you're saying, there's a lot of misinformation about like the get behind the line and things that people think it's normal, but it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Luis, may I ask, just as a Latino here in Iowa, what do you find to be the biggest challenges most recently?
Oh, most recently? I think social media is the biggest challenge. Just the information, in particularly in rural areas where Fox News is a free channel that people can access to, that may be the only information that people have. So if you listen to Fox, I don't know if you have, but if you want to get your blood pressure a little bit up, you can listen to it and understand what the talking points are, and then you're able to understand more of what people are actually thinking, and which mm-hmm. is sometimes it's mm-hmm. too accurate.
Luis, thank you very much for calling and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
You too. Okay, let's finish up this conversation. We have about 5 minutes left with Daryl Wanser-Serrano and Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa. What do we need to get out there? I want to make sure that people are reminded of how they can take part in this symposium. Tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if we mentioned the date. It's October 25th. So that's
right, we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, again, coming to, in this case, the Merge Studio in downtown Iowa City, if you're in the area, going to Imagining Latinidades, you know, putting that in a search engine and finding access to our social media, Twitter at Imagining Lat is another place where you can find us. You know, I think the caller just raises an interesting point about just information, right? So I think the caller's basic grievance is that there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Right.
And, you know, that's true. And this is just a really complicated topic. And, you know, what we're trying to do is deal with that, deal with information, right? Help people better understand what's going on.
All right. And to that point here, too, perhaps we can spend a couple minutes ticking off some more myths to dispel. I looked up this morning as preparation for this. The Pew Research Center put out key facts about U.S. Hispanics and their diverse heritage. And a lot of these really do dispel myths or things that certainly I think many of us didn't know. I certainly didn't know. The vast majority of Latinos are U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
79% of Latinos living in the country are U.S. citizens, up from 74% in 2010. The share of Latinos who speak English proficiently has increased. 70% of Latinos ages 5 or older speak English proficiently. What else here? Latinos, and we talked about this. Perhaps you want to address this as well, because this is a changing in the future. Latinos' economic conditions vary widely. And here, not only by age, we're talking about the coming generation, but here, by origin group.
Yeah, no, I think when you talk about sort of some of the issues of social anxiety, you know, a lot of that is rooted in ideas of cultural difference. So, you know, Spanish language versus English language is part of that, right? The idea of just, you know, being immigrant versus being native born. But it's important to remember that all this stuff changes over time, that the ideas of assimilation or acculturation, they just sort of happen organically. And so nobody comes into the United States as Spanish-dominant, raises a whole bunch of Spanish-dominant children who then go on to raise a bunch of Spanish-dominant children, right? As this community spends, it gets more and more rooted in the United States, in Iowa, then they just, you know, they become Iowans who are Latino, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Can we look to previous waves of immigrations from other immigrants to back up what you're saying? 100 years ago, what would it have been? Maybe the Irish who were ostracized or looked down upon in certain ways.
Sure, or Germans here in Iowa, right?
Right.
And I think that, yeah, when you look at the history of immigration in this country, you see those changing forces that take place over the years. But I think that's also an important part of the story to remember when we're thinking about how we're treating people who are immigrants today, right? The fact is that the vast majority of people in this country have immigrant roots. And so, you know, remembering that most of us are kind of in it together in that regard, and that there isn't malice on the part of people who are recent migrants, that in fact, you know, they're doing the same thing that your Iowan, you know, grandparents and great grandparents and did generations ago.
Yeah. And, you know, it's important, you know, Daryl was mentioning earlier about historicizing this. You know, when people arrived in Ellis Island, the turnaround rate was 2%. So 98% of the people that wanted to enter the United States could just enter the United States, right? So basically, there was no line. You just showed up and you were in.
Yeah.
Right?
That 2% must have been.
I don't know.
You were virtually guaranteed entry.
Right. And so that's how it worked for these previous generation of immigrants. And that's not the situation in which many.
What is the situation now?
Well, again, now it's way more complicated, right? So it depends on what country you're from. It depends on your skill level, right? It depends on if you have sort of relatives in the United States. But for a lot of people, it's basically impossible, right? And so it's important to remember that, yes, we're a country of immigrants. And yes, you want to say, come in the right way, come in the way my grandparents did. But the way your grandparents came in is different. And we have to be cognizant of that.
All right. Thank you very much for this hour of discussion. Very interesting. Renee Rocha, professor of political science and Latino studies at the University of Iowa. Daryl Wanser Serrano, director of the Latina Studies Program at the UI. And we appreciate it and wish you well on your series of symposia here. And this is a conversation that we will continue, no doubt. Thank you both.
Thanks for having this conversation, Ben.
Yeah, thanks so much.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. With help from Stephanie Nobrega, I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.